This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Back in the 1980s, Japan seemed poised to become the world's wealthiest country. Then in 1989, the country suffered an economic collapse. There were a lot of people at the time that felt that, in time, Japan would bounce back. But that really hasn't happened. And, in fact, our guest this morning, journalist Michael Zelenziger, says that the failure to recover has left many Japanese, particularly young Japanese, feeling lost. And in his new book that we'll talk about here this morning, the book Shutting Out the Sun, he looks at what seems to be a growing kind of phenomenon in Japanese society. That is, young men, particularly, shutting themselves up in their rooms, sometimes for months or years at a time. There are also growing numbers of young women who have refused to marry or bear children. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the alienation of Japan's youth and what that means for the country's future. The book, Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation, is published by Nantelis Doubleday. You certainly should be able to find it in bookstores now. Our guest is a visiting scholar at the Institute of East Asian Studies at UC Berkeley. He was the Tokyo-based bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers for 7 years. Before moving to Tokyo, he also served as the Pacific Rim correspondent for the San Jose Mercury News, and he was finalist for the 1995 Pulitzer Prize in international reporting for a series that he did on China. As we talk here, questions are welcome, as always. All we ask of callers is people just are brief, so we can keep the program moving along. But anyone listening is welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can call us. Mr. Zelenziger, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Great pleasure to be with you.
It's probably just good for just a moment to go back and to remind people about what we thought about Japan back in the 80s. And I'm sure people will remember this point where there, here in the United States, at least if you looked at popular media, it was almost hysterical. So many articles about the Japanese and how they were doing it and what they were doing and can we learn from them and can we compete with them? The tone of all of this was, it was like the Second World War being replayed, but this time on economic terms, and there was some doubt as to what the outcome would be.
There was, in a sense, no doubt. Everybody assumed that the Japanese had won.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the emblematic book of that era was Japan is Number One,
mm-hmm.
which basically argued that the Japanese had all the answers. They had created this perfect industrial society where there were no ghettos, there was no crime, where everybody was middle class, and everybody got along. And the message of that book, and others like Theory Z, for instance, was, gee, look at all the things we can learn from the Japanese, and look at what they've done to sort of eat our lunch economically, and all is gloom and doom. Now, it is true that there was a great deal about industrial production and processing that the Japanese took from the American system, the classic cases of Edward Deming, the master of sort of continuous improvement on the factory line, took something that we had thought about and really implemented in a way that we didn't bother to do because we were sort of fat and happy. So the competitiveness threat of the Japanese in the 80s was real. But obviously, events didn't turn out the way we thought.
Yeah. Well, what happened in 1989?
Well, the instant reason for the collapse of what was called the bubble economy in 1989 and 1990 was that the Bank of Japan, seeing the incredible run-up of interest rates, these were the days when it was said that the grounds of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo were worth more on paper than all of the real estate in the state of California. This is also the era, of course, when Japanese big business owned Rockefeller Center and most of downtown Los Angeles and had bought the Pebble Beach Golf Course. There was a sense that foreigners are buying up everything in this country on the cheap. Well, in 1989, at the end of the 1989, the Bank of Japan decided the party had gone a little bit too long, and they slightly raised interest rates. But in pricking that bubble, they also led to a spiral of collapse in the real estate market, and because the Japanese economic system was propped up by real estate, this led to dire consequences that took years to work through and arguably are still not worked through even today.
Mm. Well, I certainly think it's true that at the time that the bubble burst, I think there were a lot of people who perhaps thought, well, Japan's going to go through some bad times, but it'll bounce back. In fact,
exactly.
you write in the book that when you moved there in 1996 to report on Japan, you thought that you would be witnessing, as you write here in the book, you would witness the resurgence of the world's economic dynamo. And so now it's been more than 15 years, and it just hasn't happened.
Exactly, and that's what really sort of starts me on this journey of this book, because there's this great mystery story. What happened to this powerhouse? What happened to this country known as Japan? Your listeners remember very well that in 1991, we had a, by comparison to the Japanese recession, a tiny little recession, and this unknown, in those days, political strategist named James Carville said to Bill Clinton, "It's the economy, stupid." And we had a big campaign about the future of our economic policy, and a new party took office, and arguably there were economic changes that the new team brought into the country, and by the way, we got out of our recession. What you notice in Japan is that a lot of the things that we use in our country for what economists refer to as creative destruction are kind of short-circuited in Japan. There's very little risk-taking. There's very little venture capital. I mean, I used to live in Silicon Valley, where that was like an essential part of, you know, how companies were reconnected, or stitched back together, so to speak. But those things don't really exist in the same way that in our country we have sometimes maverick shareholders and such a thing as shareholder rights. I worked for a company, Knight Ridder Newspapers, that went away last year because some shareholders didn't like the way the company was being managed and forced a sale. Those kind of means of reviving an economic problem don't really exist in modern Japan. And that's what set me off to understand how could this country that seems on the surface so smooth and consistent just seems to be, you know, lost.
Yeah. Well, what you're doing, and I think it's very interesting, to sort of look at this problem, it's society in microcosm, mm-hmm. to try to understand society and then understand perhaps why it is that some people would feel so alienated and how that maybe translates into where Japan is economically and socially. You look at this group of people, of young men, and nobody apparently knows precisely how many, but it could be a lot of young men,
right.
who have literally dropped out of,
yes.
society and in a very literal way have locked themselves up in their rooms. They're living there with their families, existing behind closed doors and hardly ever going outside. And it is a real, it even has in, there's even a Japanese term for it.
Yes, the term is called hikikomori, which means social isolation syndrome. Let me make two points. The first is, I went to Japan as you're classically trained as a journalist, sort of political writer. I wrote about parties, I wrote about politics, I wrote about factories and businesses. I mean, I once worked in Chicago covering city politics. So, I mean, that was the training, and that was the eye I brought to Japan. Except that after a while, I realized that those traditional tools didn't help explain the inability of this country to change. And this bothered me for quite a long time. When I learned about these shut-ins, what are called the hikikomori, literally social isolates, I began to feel as if this was not only a very powerful metaphor, but that if you were to pull the string that unraveled the complex of issues that kept these young men locked up in their rooms for years at a time, then you really have some insight into the nature of the society that has had so much trouble adjusting to the post-industrial age. As I thought more about it, I began to see that part of the problem for Japan wasn't simply just interest rates, but that in its highly disciplined, highly ordered, highly machined system, it had created a perfect industrial society, but not a very good post-industrial society. And what I learned from talking to these young men, what your listeners should understand is that these million or so hikikomori, 80% of the men, if you give them a DSM, as the psychiatrists would talk about it, the way we diagnose patients, these men are not schizophrenic. They're not agoraphobics. In fact, when you sit down and talk to them, as I was privileged to do, you find they're very smart, very sophisticated, very highly self-aware young people who want to live a different kind of life than their parents have been forced to live. But in Japanese society, they have no safe place to express their identity, their selfhood, because so much of Japanese society is built around collectivism, about group harmony. Hmm. You know, when I give talks, I explain that in our society, in American society, there is probably no virtue more important than being independent. You know, we teach our children to stand on their own 2 feet and think for themselves. And by contrast, to be dependent is a terrible notion. You're welfare dependent. You're drug dependent. What a terrible thing to be. Well, interestingly enough, in Japanese society, it's exactly the reverse. To be dependent means to put others before you and to kind of adjust yourself to the demands of a group, whereas to be independent is to be selfish and to put yourself ahead of others. And part of what's going on in Japan is the search for individuation in a world that really was created around collective values and collective norms.
It's just, it's hard to imagine how something like this could happen, how someone as a teenager could literally drop out of life, could stay in their bedroom, could be expected to be taken care of by their parents, and that this kind of thing could go. Literally, we're talking about guys who did this when they were in high school or maybe when they were in their late teens and spent years, maybe decades living this way. It's sort of hard to imagine how a thing could be.
Well, part of it is because, you know, the Japanese system is one where, for instance, a parent of a child who is has shut himself up in his room is very embarrassed, really, to seek help. You know, no, in a lot of these cases, no counselor comes to the house. There's no truant officer. And because the parent feels so much shame in actually seeking help, it's actually even worse in rural communities where the notion of a parent going to a public health center to ask for help, just the mere visit of the parent to a clinic will start off all kinds of sort of vicious gossip and rumor in the very small town community of rural Japan, which in some ways is even more intrusive than rural Illinois, probably. Mm. So there are a lot of constraints for these parents for seeking help, in addition to which the nature of social intervention and mental health treatment and some of the things we take for granted in the West is very underdeveloped in a country as prosperous as Japan. A little anecdote. I had a Japanese friend who went to see a therapist in Japan, a Japanese therapist. And this woman was married to an American and had lived in America for a while, so I knew her English was very good. And I said to her, "Mugi-san, what language do you speak to with the therapist?" She said, "Oh, we both speak in English because you don't have the words in Japanese to do it." So it's a cultural problem as well as a psychological problem. There are a lot of constraints. The other thing is, in the seams of Japanese society, there is no Oprah Winfrey. There is no Dr. Phil. Japanese don't openly talk about these kind of problems because they've been taught from an early age to gama, as they say in Japanese, to endure, to suffer for the good of the community or the family. So the notion that you should complain and seek individual help or support for problems you confront is not in the DNA, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, there are therapists who work with hikikomori, and you talked with some of them.
Yes. One of the things I found fascinating is I was actually invited by some psychiatrists to come work with their patients because these were doctors who were treating 25-year-old men who didn't leave their homes except to go to the doctor's office. And what the psychiatrist would say to me is, because you speak pretty decent Japanese, but you don't look Japanese, you don't have the nonverbal kind of behavior patterns of a normal Japanese, my patients find you more trusting. They are willing to talk to you as a foreigner because they know you won't judge them the way a Japanese will. And this, in a way, will help open them up. In similar fashion, the only reason I was able to reach many of these social isolates or these hikikomori was because the parents would say, "We have no one else to turn to, and maybe if you as a foreigner will write about this subject, maybe we'll get the Japanese government to pay some attention."
Is your book available in Japan?
It's going to be published in Japan probably in March. I had hoped that it would come out a little bit sooner, but I have no. There's only certain things I have control over. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that there are many Japanese who are very excited about this book coming out in Japanese, but there are others who are worried about it because they think the book itself might be sort of toned down for the Japanese market. Mm-hmm. I'm basically saying that these kids are part of a giant, very quiet rebellion. if you were asking to sum up the difference between an 18-year-old in Japan and an 18-year-old in America who might also feel rebellious or unhappy with his life at home or worried about his future, an American adolescent is likely to act out. He might dye his hair purple or get a tattoo or play loud music his parents can't stand, or God forbid, in certain cases that we've seen lately, occasionally very unhappy kids go into schools with guns. That's unfortunately seems to be an emerging fabric in American society. What I argue in this book is that while we act out, the Japanese are forced to act inward. They have to hide inwardly. It's also why Japanese girls won't get married. They don't want to be part of a society that won't let them not only have a career but also have motherhood. They'd rather live with their parents into their late 30s and 40s and take expensive trips to Paris or to New York to go shopping than they would to have a career and a family, because they know their husbands won't participate in family life.
And that's sort of the flip side of the hikikomori. We have here the young men who are dropping out in the extreme, and then we have young women who are doing something sort of similar. What they're doing is they're saying, well, I don't want the traditional role for a woman in Japan. I'm not going to do it.
Right.
They're in some cases, they may be well-educated, quite capable, have good jobs, but the other stuff, the wife and mother stuff, they're simply saying, no, I'm just not going to do it.
And they won't do it because the great gap in Japan and the great expectation gap is between educated Japanese women and educated Japanese men. What do I mean by that? An educated Japanese woman today compared to 30 years ago, a college-educated American woman, has far more opportunity to make a good living in the service sector. She doesn't have to get her hands dirty in the fields or in the factory. She can, you know, work doing financial services or be a travel agent or do all kinds of things where she can have a very good living in the service world. And so in American society, we see a lot of situations where father and mother share child-rearing chores. But in Japan, the most educated men still say, I'm not a real man unless my wife stays at home and my wife takes care of the child and doesn't work. And so slowly, educated men are beginning to change their attitude, but very, very slowly. Most Japanese men can find stay-at-home wives, but Japanese educated women can't find husbands willing to let them work. And so their response is to say, I won't do it. I won't get married. I won't have children. And that's why the birth rate in Japan is so low. Birth rate in Japan, the fertility rate is 1.2. Japan was very notable because, you know, we're about to have our 300 millionth American. Japan last year had 15,000 more people die than were born. So the country is rapidly depopulating, and it's getting very old. Japan is going to make South Florida look like a youth hostel, because by 2020, one of every 9 Japanese is going to be over the age of 80. So this is not sustainable in a society where there's no immigration, where Japan still wants to hide out from the world, so to speak, and not let foreigners in. So this creates a lot of real kind of concern about what an older, aging, shrinking Japan is going to look like.
Our guest, Michael Zielinziger, is a journalist. He's been writing about economics, politics, and Asia for more than 2 decades. He was the Tokyo-based bureau chief for Knight Ridder newspapers for 7 years. Before moving to Tokyo, he served as the Pacific Rim correspondent for the San Jose Mercury News. He's now a visiting scholar at the Institute of East Asian Studies at UC Berkeley and is author of the recently published book Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation, published by Nantelis Doubleday. We do have a caller here who's been patient, and I want to get right to them. Someone listening in Chicago on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I find this very interesting because in the old days, if you got a job, say, in one of Japan's major industries, in the automobile industry or something like that, you could expect to be there for the rest of your life. You didn't have to worry about being laid off or anything. And in fact, I used to work for a Japanese photo studio here in America, and I know that they would work easily a 60-hour week and not think anything about it. What I'd like to know is, now Japan is going through an economic hard times. I know they used to, I thought anyway, sort of took a nose in the air up toward the West and in effect said, you should be like us and this kind of thing. What I'd like to know now, though, is how does this affect Japanese businesses in the United States?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. First, the question of lifetime employment. We used to talk about the jewels of the Japanese employment system. One of them was lifetime employment, and the other was a seniority wage. Every year you got a raise, kind of like
right.
what used to be in union life in Illinois. One of the things that happened in the 90s, all these companies were so burdened with bad debt that because of the intense social contract of Japan, of the unwillingness to kind of face up to the debts that you have, the big Japanese companies basically stopped hiring young people. They kept their 40- and 50-year-olds, but if you were 22 years old and got out of a good college in Japan, which is supposed to be your ticket to a permanent ride, so to speak, you were out of luck. Now, of course, some people got jobs, but there were a whole lot of others who basically had no choice. They couldn't find full-time work. The other revealing thing that happened is that in the last 5 or 6 years, some of these talented Japanese who got full-time jobs after a year or two quit them. They said, I can't handle this kind of environment where it's obedience and do what the boss tells you, and I have to wait 25 years to have any control. So they just kind of walked out.
Well, I know where I worked here in America, that's exactly what it was like. If you got sick, they would call the boss, and the boss would say to you, you know, you got to come in, and we'll make these decisions for you as possible. This was in the 60s and 70s. Though.
Well, as I talk about this in the book, there's a whole problem now with middle-aged salary man, as they're called. Two things. Number one, we didn't discuss this yet, but the Japanese suicide rate for males is among the highest in the world. Three times as many Japanese kill themselves as die in car accidents in Japan. And this is because if you're in their 40s and your 50s, there is so much stress to perform, there is so much unpaid overtime, and there's a sense of the bad debts creeping up on you that haven't been paid off, that men just kind of lose hope. And also, by the way, in Japanese society, unlike ours, you can get survivor's benefits for suicide. So there's actually an economic incentive for a guy burdened by debts to kill himself.
So now, this raise every year, this cost of living adjustment, everything, in effect,
yes.
It bankrupted them.
Yes. Well, the other thing is, because unlike American society, the banks and the corporations owned each other, what we used to call cross-shareholding, which is slowly being unwound in Japan, but really relatively slowly. Imagine if you're an American, right, and your bank owns a big part of GM, and GM owns a big part of your bank, and everybody in the bank drives a GM car, and every GM worker has a bank account in that bank. How likely is it that the bank's going to call in a bad loan to GM? You know, we have seen over the past 15 years that slowly the Japanese are beginning to unwind these ugly positions. But it has taken a very, very long time. And the reality is, if you're young and entrepreneurial in Japan, very difficult to start a company, impossible to get a loan. But if you're an old company, your loans will be rolled over.
How do they feel about the South Koreans growing as an economy? Does this make them nervous?
Well, I speak about this in the book. It's remarkable to see how quickly, I should remind the listeners that in 1997-1998, Korea went through an incredible economic downturn. It was called the IMF crisis, where basically Korea went to the world through the IMF and said, if you don't write us a $58 billion check tomorrow, Korea goes out of business. Now, this was the 10th largest economy. Look at Korea today. A lot more foreign direct investment, a lot more globally competitive companies. Even in Illinois now, people aren't buying Sony TV sets. They're buying Samsung TV sets.
Mm.
Even in Illinois, people are buying Kias and Hyundais from Korea. They're now becoming increasingly competitive with the Japanese car makers because the Koreans said, we have to change the way we do business. The Japanese are much less reluctant to do it. Your original call was, how has the economic situation changed in terms of American corporations? The Japanese are far less aggressive today in the American market in terms of acquisitions than they used to be. You don't see Japanese hunting up and down America to buy new companies.
This used to make a lot of Americans nervous.
Sorry?
This used to make a lot of Americans nervous.
And now we're worried about China because we tend to think about this as a threat rather than as an opportunity. Japan is basically in an environment where 10% of the Japanese economy are the companies that you know, the Canons, the Mitsubishis, the Hondas, that compete effectively across the globe and are among the best producers of what they make, whether it's cameras or cars. Unknown to most Americans is that 90% of the Japanese economy is moribund. It's full of incredibly uncompetitive companies with no competition because foreign direct investment doesn't go to Japan. There's been more foreign direct investment in China in the last 3 years than in Japan since the end of World War II. It's just not a relatively open economy.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're already at our midpoint, and I have some other callers I want to get to. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to Kankakee next. This is line one. Hello.
The phenomenon of the retired teenagers, 20 and 30-year-olds in Japan, is fascinating. And the Japanese uniqueness.
Yes.
As well. As you say in Shutting Out the Sun, we in America run the risk over time of becoming as insular and isolated as modern Japan. We have, however, now in our own way, something like this phenomenon here already. The snow that falls on Mount Fuji, in your caller's humble opinion, does differ from the snow atop Mount Fuji. Your caller rambles, but you say that Japanese young people who retire in their teens, 20s, and 30s do better if they get out of Japan into a society where they can do well. I speculate that maybe if we bring some to our community, some who do well here or do well after being here, go back to Japan and find a way.
I was just at an event yesterday in Philadelphia where I met an English a gentleman who teaches English as a second language. And he said, I'm so relieved and happy to get this book because I've had these Japanese students who show up to school to learn English. And when they first show up, it's very clear that they haven't been in school and they haven't been working. And I kind of ask them, so what have you been doing the last 3 or 4 years? And they kind of don't really say. And they're kind of very kind of afraid and anxious and kind of don't know how to get along with people. But after they've been in America a couple of months and begin to learn English, they completely change. And what I argue in the book is if you put these seeds, these young men, in a different soil, they actually begin to blossom and bloom. I know of a number of these hikikomori, of these social recluses who go to Vancouver or go to Bangkok or come to America and live for a while in a society that doesn't have so many expectations and so many communal rules and are not quite as disciplined. My favorite story about this is about one young man who went to Thailand because he just couldn't stand being in Japan. His parents gave him a ticket to be in Thailand for a couple of weeks. And he got on a bus to go to the countryside. And the bus was supposed to leave at 11 a.m. And at 11:06, the bus hadn't left yet. And the man said to himself, gee, I guess the bus driver is waiting for more passengers. I can live in a place that's more relaxed like this. If any of your listeners have been in Japan and want to get on a Shinkansen or bullet train, you know that the 10:58 bullet train leaves at 10:57 in 58 seconds. And if you're, 2 seconds late, you're out of luck. Other countries aren't quite as rigid, including our own. Our train system isn't as good as the Japanese system either. There are penalties you pay for a system that's less disciplined. But what I'm basically arguing is that Japan moved from an industrial to, as the world moved from an industrial to a post-industrial world. We don't just make hardware anymore. We don't just stamp out, parts in a stamping plant anymore. We build software. We have all kinds of individual, we now mass produce for individual needs. We have lots of customization that goes on in the world. People are empowered to be themselves in the IT and internet world. Japan is very bad at that game, and that's why it's consigned to a difficult future.
An important book, a must-read. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Let's go to back here to someone in Urbana, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
How are you? I lived in Okinawa when I was a kid, and, before it was returned to the Japanese. And I remember my parents talking about the, not so much the Okinawan influence, but the Japanese influence. And I had a chance to go to Japan 36 years ago when I was coming back from Southeast Asia. And I always thought of the Japanese as sort of, as you said earlier, an insular society and sort of incapable of, they don't like outsiders at all. I mean, they accept them in their culture, but they seem to have this sort of, almost like a hubris and an arrogance that, if you sort of see films of the World War II and sort of this whole, refusing to surrender type of thing. And I'm wondering if that's sort of to their detriment. And in a way, they seem to strike me as the perfect definition of xenophobia. They'll allow outsiders in, they'll look at them, but they have this sort of like arrogance about their culture in themselves, and it seems to be backfiring in this globalized economy.
Exactly. I actually don't use the word xenophobia in the book, but I make a different point about what I call social trust.
Yeah.
What's fascinating about Japan as opposed to America is other people in the world look at us Americans as being sort of naively optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
We befriend people on the street. If you ask Americans, if I meet a stranger, can I trust him? By 60 to 70% consistently, according to the Gallup poll, we say yes. We basically are trusting of others. And that has to do with the character of a very heterogeneous society, mm-hmm. where we learn to negotiate with people from other faiths, other regions of the country, other, you know, different backgrounds. Japan, by contrast, is unbelievably homogeneous, as you point out. It's very resistant to immigration. It's racially virtually identical. The Japanese all believe they come from the Yamato race. But if you ask the Japanese the same version of that question, do you trust others, the Japanese have an aphorism, which translates as, the stranger I meet in the road is likely to be a robber, which is a statement of exactly the opposite of our view.
Yeah.
If you ask Japanese, do you believe in that aphorism, 70% say yes. And what I argue in the book is, in Japan, as long as you are in a group, a defined group, whether it's your family group to which you were born or your company group, then you have incredible amounts of social trust with those around you. But leave that group or deal with people from outside your group, it's kind of like Chicago ward politics, where the question is not who are you, it's who sent you.
Yeah.
And unless Japan can learn how to create looser ties of social trust rather than these strong ties that bind people so closely, it's very difficult to operate in a globalized world. And one of the tragic symbolisms of these hikikomori is these social isolates is, you know, we have this, we say in America, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did the tree fall? Mm-hmm. I kind of raise the same question about these hikikomori. If I'm not a part of any group and I sit alone in my room for years at a time, do I really exist in Japanese society?
Yeah.
And even today, I'm not quite sure of the answer. I believe Japan's globalization problem is a real constraint to it moving forward. That's why questions of foreign direct investment mm-hmm. are so important to Japan's future. Is the country really going to open itself up or not? That's one of the reasons China is stealing a march on Japan, because China has said, not only, of course, is it starting from a lower base, not only are Chinese working at, you know, 20 cents on the Japanese yen, but there's, you know, the Chinese has said, we can learn from the West. We can import technology and export and become part of the global environment, and the Japanese are still very, very reluctant to do that.
Yeah, well, yeah. And do you think they'll change by necessity or out of just literally forced to change? Will they? I mean, are they so intransigent? Will they not change? Yeah, I just don't know what's going to happen with that.
Let me give you the Japanese answer to this.
Yeah.
Many Japanese I talk to say the only way that Japan, this is the Japanese way of thinking about
yeah.
it, the only way Japan changes is through what are called black ships. The first black ship was, of course, Commodore Perry in 1853, who forced Japan open, which in itself created the Meiji Restoration and the rush to industrialization. Of course, the second black ship was the horrific nuclear bombing of atomic bombing mm-hmm. of Hiroshima, which forced the Japanese to surrender. And then, and as some historians like John Dower in his wonderful book Embracing Defeat points out, within about 2 weeks, this whole nation that had been essentially propagandized and brainwashed for 20 years to think we were the evil white people was quick to embrace the victor and try to be like Americans and try, and we made a deal with the Japanese, you know, we will help rebuild you, we will open our market to your exports as long as you will support our military strategies in Asia. Japanese say to me, we need another black ship to come in here because otherwise we won't change on our own. Now that to me is a very damning indictment,
yeah.
but it does reflect a society where, you know, non-government organizations are almost non-existent. There is really no charity. The media system in Japan is very respectful of power. There's not a lot of critical inquiry, and there's not a lot of entrepreneurship. So what is going to force forward the creative destruction you need for society to rebuild itself? That is the question.
Well, thanks a lot. It's a great story.
Thanks
yeah.
for the call.
Thank you.
Well, it seems to me, though, that even though it is true that Japan changed dramatically in some fundamental ways as a result of the forced opening to the West, the experience during World War II, and the aftermath, there are some characteristics of Japanese culture that have still been stable over time. And
absolutely.
For such a long period of time, it makes one wonder whether those things are changeable.
Well, that's right. You know, clearly Japan has a incredibly long-lasting culture, important culture. And I am very careful in this book to say, look, there's a whole lot about Japan and the character of its society that is stuff we should admire. The Japanese have a sense of craftsmanship. The Japanese have a sense of honoring the customer, and especially in personal dealings. You know, that's why do Americans buy Japanese electronics and Japanese cars? Because we think for the money, they are great values, and because we know a Japanese car will last for a long time. You know, the Japanese have been able, this discipline that we discuss is one of the reasons why the Japanese factory floor is very different than what has traditionally been the American factory floor, where, you know, union and management are arguing, and there's a sense of disenfranchisement, and the American workers feel taken advantage of. In Japan, there's been always much more of a sense of unity because of these notions of we're going to take care of you going forward. I actually do use this metaphor of the hikikomori to explore the nature of the Japanese character. The nature, you know, this is a society that doesn't have transcendental values. It doesn't have a fixed sense of right and wrong. You ask a Japanese what's right, they'll say what's right today is what a majority of Japanese believe is right. It's what we call contextual ethics and contextual values. And if the mood of the society changes tomorrow, then the sense of what's right changes. Now, we, in a sense, are more fundamentalists. We believe this is always right and this is always wrong. I don't mean fundamentalist in the fundamentalist Christian sense, but literally, we believe there are certain lines you can't cross. But the Japanese never feel that way. And so I actually think Japan has a struggle trying to somehow free up the incredible power of the individual. Because remember, the Japanese are hardworking people who, you know, respect their fellow man at a certain level. There is not a lot of street crime and violence. It's a highly functioning society, but it's also, ironically, a very unhappy one.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Michael Zielinziger. He's a journalist, has been a journalist, and covered Asia for a number of years. He was the Tokyo-based bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers for 7 years, and before moving to Tokyo, he served as the Pacific Rim correspondent for the San Jose Mercury News. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 95 for international reporting for a series he did on China. He's now a visiting scholar at the Institute of East Asian Studies at UC Berkeley, and is author of the new book, Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation. It's a Nantelis Doubleday book out in the bookstores now if you want to read it. And again, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. I thought you wrote a piece that appeared near the end of September, and I think this was for the LA Times, about Japan, talking about some of the things that you have here talked about this morning and in the book, and also talking about the new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, and you know who he is, and also talking a little bit about Japanese politics, and I guess particularly the idea of a growing sense of nationalism in Japanese politics, and something of a possibility of a more of a move toward the right.
Yeah. Shinzo Abe, of course, replaced Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi at the end of September. His resume by Japanese standards is rather thin compared to the traditional politician. He's 52 years old, which by Japanese standards makes him almost like a John F. Kennedy, the shockingly young prime minister. What I've been suggesting, this is really separate from the book because I couldn't predict a year ago when the book was finished that Abe would take over. But, you know, those of your listeners who went and saw Lost in Translation, that movie about Japan a couple of years ago, you get the sense of this highly functional, very glossy society that's a little bit difficult to penetrate. But as I point out in the book, below the surface, there's a lot of seething anger and hostility. Japanese have kind of lost their place in the world. We think they're about to turn the corner economically, but yet their economic growth is, 0.2% last quarter. And interest rates there, imagine if you have $100,000 that you put in the bank, which in Japan, they're a country of savers, and at the end of a year you get $100 or so. That's how low interest rates are in Japan. So Japan has been battling this 15-year deflation. Young people are out of work. In addition to the million young men who we believe hide in their rooms, there's another 3 million young adults that Japanese refer to as NEETs, not in employment, education, or training. As I said to the caller earlier, in that period when the Japanese big companies weren't hiring young workers, there are lots of Japanese who are working at part-time convenience store clerks or pizza delivery men. And in a society where it's very difficult to get a job at age 30 because you're hired right out of college, these guys are kind of wandering through life like flotsam in the ocean. So there's this unrest and unhappiness and disaffection in Japan, a sense of a nation that's lost its way. And as we've seen in other societies in the past, that kind of disaffection sometimes leads to calls for more nationalism. And ironically, this new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, is saying we should rewrite our constitution, the constitution the Americans really wrote for the Japanese. And we should get rid of Article 9 that renounces the use of collective defense to support the nation. In other words, we should, I mean, Japan has a self-defense force, but we should end the fiction and become a normal military again. And if the North Korea threat gets serious, perhaps we should really rearm. And there are some Japanese who talk about maybe Japan should now go nuclear. Although Abe this week said in the Diet, that which is the Japanese parliament, that was not his intention today. What I'm trying to say is the Americans view very blithely Japan as this long-term ally with whom, when we ask them to jump, they say, how high? What I say is that's true, but there is some fragility and brittleness in modern Japan today that a savvy prime minister can take advantage of. And if we're not careful, we could see a Japan that is militarizing, but is also trying to get away from the American embrace, as I think it should. You know, just outside the spotlight held by Shinzo Abe are men like Shintaro Ishihara, who's still the governor of Tokyo, who is, of course, famous to your listeners for having written the book, The Japan That Can Say No. There is still a lot of fierce nationalism in Japan. What we need to guide Japan towards is a balanced nationalism. I don't have any problem with Japanese who feel proud to salute their flag and support the national soccer team and sing the national anthem. But it has to be a Japan in which students are actually taught their history, actually learn what happened in World War II, actually learn about the very brutal Japanese conquest of Korea, that learn about what happened in Manchuria and in Nanjing. You know, our American high school students learn, and college students learn about the Japanese occupation of China. But Japanese students don't. Today, if you go into the shrine next to the museum next to the Yasukuni Shrine, which is this war memorial, the occupation of China is viewed as this glorious encounter of the Japanese military. So Japanese needs to be a more balanced, you know, role in the world, and I worry that with a little bit of a too much push from the United States, it could actually help re-spark an arms race in Asia.
Let's talk with someone here in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was going to call about comparisons to the U.S., but on this last note, I think the U.S. needs to learn things about what we did in the Philippines and Lincoln's opposition to the Mexican War and things like that, too. So I don't think any state is really immune to that kind of...
No argument about that. But let me go back. I get the sense of your question. I hear it a lot. So what about America? You know, I deliberately wrote a book that's mostly about Japan. But I do sense in America today a loss of community, a loss of communitarian values, a sense of group responsibility. I have a tentative conclusion about that I actually want to spend some more time thinking about, and I'd love to hear from you as well.
Well, I think it's great that you're looking at that, because what I was thinking about was, as far as socially isolates, what do we have in the homeless? What do we have in the Vietnam vets who are drinking themselves to death? I mean, they don't commit suicide with a harikari knife, but a lot of them, and I've seen some just very recently, who are really just killing themselves slowly, and they're very socially isolated. They're not staying with their parents, and they're a different age bracket. But
I'm very glad you brought up the question of the Vietnam veterans, because one of the fascinating things that you learn when you try to investigate the pathology of the social isolation in Japan is that many of the psychiatrists and psychologists dealing with these young adults believe they are also, like the Vietnam War veterans, victims of PTSD, of post-traumatic stress disorder. We know the stress that a soldier faces, the stress that these young adults face, is from bullying and the social pressure of schools. You know, many of these young adults have shut themselves in since the age of 15 or 16 because they were subject to such vicious abuse in junior high and high school that they just couldn't bear it. The difference in our society is that if a son is bullied, his mother will go to school and say, "My son has a right to an education." In Japan, the default response of a Japanese mother is to say to the son, what did you do to get yourself bullied? As if that he deserved it. To go back to the American and the Japanese, these are actually mirror images of societies in some ways. You know, both societies believe that they're superior and blessed by God. You know, we're the city on the hill. The Japanese were founded by the sun goddess. We're both, as I'm learning, very isolated. Japan is surrounded by water. I often joke as a journalist who used to be a foreign correspondent that 3 miles off of Los Angeles and 3 miles off of Manhattan are these two big mirrors that reflect our values back on ourselves. We don't really take the time to understand the rest of the world. The difference, I think, is whereas Japan suffers from a crisis of really repressing of the individual, we have decided to celebrate the ideology of the individual. The person is always allowed to be himself and never has to respect the rest of the community. And whereas 30 or 50 years ago, we really had institutions in a community that built community, that created what we call social capital, those are really eroding today in what I kind of the iPod man syndrome. We can pick our own music. We can pick to read what we want to. We can pick what TV shows we want to watch. And we don't have to ever communicate or by accident run into somebody any different than we are. And we need to build more means of sort of social networking and social interaction so that the heterogeneity of America can actually be a blessing and not a curse.
Well, I think it's more thoroughgoing than these cultural artifacts that you're talking about just now, the isolation of American culture, I don't know, organization man in the 50s,
sure.
I think, points to that a little bit, not very directly, and just in these moments. I share your sentiment about the remilitarization and kind of Japan. I don't want to make them an enemy. I think what we need is to understand the forces that are going on that would be driving.
Well, ironically, someone in the Bush administration really wants to push the Japanese to be much more aggressive and assertive militarily across Asia. And that's exactly the wrong message to send to China. That's exactly the wrong message to send to countries like Thailand. They're still very and especially to Korea. Korea, to me, is the keystone in the future of Asian security. I don't even mean North Korea. I mean South Korea. We have a country today that it's a booming, growing economy. In some ways, it's the internet leader in the world today. And if you take a poll in Seoul, Korea, even today, after the launch of the missile from Pyongyang, and say, who is our better friend, the North Koreans or the Americans? A majority of young Koreans say the Northerners. They believe, as one said to me when I was there recently, we only shed blood with the Americans, but we share blood with the North Koreans. Now, this is a very dangerous place. Imagine that we have troops in a country where we're really not wanted anymore because a lot of the South Koreans believe the Bush administration has not acted in good faith in its negotiations with the North. We could clearly see an opportunity where the South Korea moves ever more aggressively into the Chinese sphere of influence, and then effectively the U.S. and Japan would be on the outs in Asia. We'd have friends in Australia, we'd have friends in Japan, and otherwise we'd be in the periphery and everybody else would be in a very, very prosperous Chinese orbit. That's a real concern I have for the future of Asia.
Hmm. We're almost out of time. I think about conversations I've had on and off about Japan going back a long time and about the fact that within Japan there always have been intellectuals who have been engaging in a big debate about Japan, its need to open further, to be more involved internationally, to internationalize.
Be more global.
And be more global. And I suppose that it seems to me that there may be some tension between that continuing feeling that Japan should do that, and I don't know if this is applying the metaphor to taking it too far, but that there is some possibility that there could be some ways in which Japan could become a hikikomori nation, that is, it could become in a sense more isolated, turn inward even more.
This is actually what I argue at the end of the book. One of the reasons I think this metaphor is so powerful is because if you were to ask the Japanese people, remember, the Japanese, despite 15 years of really bad economics and very powerful, very depressing sense of deflation where prices and wages are going down year after year after year. Imagine living in a world like that. But even 15 years later, the Japanese are so prosperous, you know. What I say in the book is give the Japanese a chance. Do you want to go through 10 years of Thatcherism or Reaganism? Pick the adjective you want, of deregulation, of restructuring, of open the economy to foreign investors, of entrepreneurship. There'll be winners and there'll be losers. But at the end of it, we'll be a much happier, much stronger, prosperous society. Or do you want to basically go what you're going through now, where at least on paper, everybody is sort of going down together? There are a few winners, but basically we're all kind of slowly going downhill. No one gets hurt. And 15 years from now, instead of being the second largest economy, we're the 10th largest economy. But there's still basically food on everybody's table. What I say is, if you ask the Japanese which choice do you prefer, they'll take the latter, whereas Americans would take the former, because we're a more dynamic society. We're much more risk-taking. We're much more willing to try. You know, we also believe in the West that if you're not being born, you're at, what did Bob Dylan say? Those who are not being born are being are busy being dying.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not growing, you're dying. The Japanese kind of believe that growth and death are part of a cycle, and maybe we've seen our zenith, and it's okay if we decline.
Well, there we have to leave it. We're here at the end of the time. The book is Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation. Nantelis Doubleday is the publisher, by our guest, Michael Solenziger.
I also have a blog, by the way, at shuttingoutthesun.com.
Great. So there people can find out more about the book and other information about Asia.
Right.
Now our guest is visiting scholar, Institute of East Asian Studies, UC Berkeley. Thanks very much.
Great to be with you.
We appreciate it.